You're listening to a podcast from the Rocking Vicar.
La 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 la. Coming up on this week's festive parish council. Tea and toast in Shoreditch. The trauma of Christmas shopping. Lawrence, Llewellyn Bowen, where did it all go wrong? Kim Jong-un in Hollywood. And we review Apple's broken promises on BBC One.
Hello, everybody, and welcome once again to the Parish Council, your podcast from the Rocking Vicar. As ever, I'm Magnus Shaw, and he's deep, he's crisp, he's even, he's Terence Deckham.
That will be Magnus Shaw. Yes. Hello, Magnus
Hello.
Shaw. Yeah, you know, you're such a hipster, of course.
Oh, yeah.
We know that. And you have a district in London named after you.
Magnus, the borough, London Borough of Magnus.
Magnus Shoreditch.
Magnus Shoreditch. Yes.
Now, this week, because you are, you know, a leader in fashion and style, you decided to stay in what, you know, you hipsters call a boutique hotel.
A boutique hotel, yeah.
And I understand that all was proceeding pleasantly until it came to breakfast time.
Yeah, this was right in the heart of hipsterland. This was just off the Whitechapel Road, and it had one of those names which could easily be mistaken for an iPhone app. It wasn't called the Winchester or, you know, the Devonshire or it was. I'm not going to tell you what the name was, but it had all the vowels missing. Put it like that. Yeah, yeah. You know the deal. And actually, you know, quite an interesting experience in that, you know, there wasn't a reception desk. There was a fella stood at a pedestal with an iPad. Genuinely.
I'm loving it already.
A fellow with an iPad, that's your reception, and sort of things that you'd, quotes that you'd pull off the internet painted onto the walls, sort of motivational quotes painted onto the walls, and old packing cases, you know, the old old wooden packing cases reshaped into the form of animals in reception. That kind of thing, you know, all achingly fashionable. But yeah, quite nice, yeah, bright, breezy, clean, you know, very nice. Big room, and I got an upgrade on the room, which was nice. I wasn't supposed to have one with a window, but I got.
You have to pay extra for a window.
Yeah, well, I didn't. You see, I got upgraded. I got a lovely big window, but you do normally have to pay for it. Actually, I know some very old fashioned dowdy hotels in various cities where you have to pay for a window, so that's not unique. And the dressing table was another broken up packing case with an industrial hose stretched across it. So it's all very intriguing. And a big mural of a dog wearing sunglasses above the bed.
Oh, they saw you coming. Please go on.
All very groovy. No, it was quite nice, though. It was comfortable. And
with your upgraded window.
Upgraded window, yep. So I was very, very pleased to get the upgraded window. And all was well, you know, the bed had a TV built into it, so it was quite nice to lie in bed and watch the telly and all the rest of it. All good. Almost the end of the experience when I went down in the morning. I was only there for one night. Went down in the morning for breakfast.
All right.
So myself and Mrs. the Magnus Shaw went in for breakfast. We perused the breakfast menu, and Mrs. the Magnus Shaw had that ordered eggs on toast. And a flat white coffee, and I went for the Earl Grey tea and the toast and jam. Well, the coffee arrived, no problem at all. We sat chatting. No tea came at the same time as the coffee, as you know, you usually get your hot drinks together, don't you?
Yeah.
No eggs, no toast arrived, and you know what it's like. You just as you're chatting, it slowly starts to dawn on you that something's gone wrong, doesn't it? The passage of time starts to indicate that all is not what it might be. that was the creeping feeling I got. I thought, I'm still without tea and certainly without toast. And no eggs either. Something is going wrong. So it must be over 10 minutes or so into this that I thought, no, I don't like this. They've forgotten me. I know they've forgotten me. Wasn't busy. I wasn't busy at all. And so I went up to the achingly vintage style bar and said, oh, hello, you remember me. I'm just waiting for my tea and toast here. Oh, yes, we're just making it now. Okay, great. I said, sat back down. And then this sort of creeping anxiety increases, doesn't it, exponentially, because now you've asked and now they've said it's coming. So how quickly does something have to be coming before it's actually really coming? Or indeed, how long does it take before you begin to suspect it's still not actually coming? And it still was not actually coming.
Oh, God.
So another 5 minutes passed. I thought, well, if they're just making it, then it would have been here by now. Now, at this point, Mrs. the Magnus Shaw spotted the party at the next table were actually the management of the hotel.
Oh, you see, she's brighter than you.
Yeah, so. Considerably, and was clearly earwigging at the same time. So she went over to their table and said, oh, hello, yeah, I understand you're the management. We're guests. We are waiting for our breakfast. So far, we've had one coffee, no tea, no toast, no eggs. Oh, dear, they said. Oh, right, okay, no problem. So somebody very important looking went up to the bar. The words were had. They came back to our table and said, it'll be with you any moment now. Sorry about that. It's just being sorted. So, well, if the manager said that, we're onto a winner. It'll be here any second. Guess what? Another 5, 6, 7 minutes.
No.
The management had moved off to some presumably swanky conferencing suite to have their meeting, so we couldn't go back to them. And so Mrs. Bagshaw said, I'm not having this. This is flipping ridiculous. Let's go. Let's go out in, you know, onto the road. We'll find somewhere to eat out on Whitechapel Road. No problem at all. So we went up. We said, I'm sorry. We've just waited too long now. You know, knocking on the door of 35 minutes now. We've been waiting for a simple breakfast. Still only had one hot drink. And flustered and panicked, the lady behind the bar said, I do apologise, we're searching the whole hotel for some tea. For some tea.
You see, you insisted on these, you know, expecting these exotic items, you know, tea and toast.
Yes. Yeah. We're looking.
So they couldn't find any tea in the entire.
Everywhere for tea. No, they couldn't find any tea. Well, the irony is that rather than tea and coffee being provided in the room in this boutique hotel, it was that there was help yourself tea and coffee on each landing.
Oh, so they could have just gone up there. Well, and
yeah, exactly. I could have brought my own tea down. It was there on the landing. Hot water, tea bags, everything. Why they didn't go up there to get some tea from the landing. And then as we walked out onto the streets, most exasperated, there's a Tesco Metro sitting there.
So they could have just
within a heartbeat, they could have said, oh, hell, we've run out of tea. Here's a fiver out the till. Go and get a load of tea. But none of those things happened. So, absolutely cutting edge, hipster hotel, all the bells and whistles in place to give it that photo spread in wallpaper magazine effects that they might be after. But unfortunately, no toast, and more importantly, no tea.
And of course, this place, which will, you know, be out of business by the end of next year, will be, you know, they'll all be looking at each other and saying, you know, but we provided everything. Yeah. I can't understand.
Tried so hard. We spent £1,000 on a dressing table made out of a broken packing case and an industrial hose. How could we go bust? Yeah,
these places are terribly good, aren't they, at marketing and ensuring all the photos on their websites feature that on their website, you know, features the wacky Elvis mannequin on the landing and the neon signs in the bathroom.
Yes. But the world is a jukebox in the lift. And the
reality is somewhat odd. I stayed in a boutique hotel in Brighton, which promised much on its website and charged accordingly. Magnus Shaw, £150 a night. They got me for. And it turned out, I mean, it looked fabulous on the website and everything. It turned out to be a guest house in one of those squares near the pier in Brighton. And the rooms were tiny. I remember the bathroom was a cupboard. And I really do mean it was a cupboard. Yeah. There was a shower in a cupboard. You know, there was damp everywhere. And the other thing is, if the people in the next room blinked, you could hear it.
Oh, no.
Yes, indeed. And most of the quirky items in the room, you know, to make it a boutique hotel were from a pound shop. There was a four. There was this. They advertised a four poster bed. You see, and I thought, oh, and what it was exactly that. It was a bed with four posts sticking up, one at each corner, and to try and create the boutique experience, what they'd done. This is something about the pound shop. They'd wrapped a faux feather boa around each post.
Nice.
You know, so that was the boutique. It's, you know, and I got a parking ticket while I was there. So, you know, yeah, I remember saying at the time, not so much boutique, more antique. Yeah, you've got here.
Well, this place had obviously, you know, made the investment in all the trendy stuff. I don't think any of it came from a pound shop, and I think they fulfilled their hipster brief. And the bed was comfy, and the room was bright and clean and nice. But if you've forgotten to lay on any tea at breakfast, something has gone awry, hasn't it?
Terribly much so. I don't know about you, but the whole etiquette of hotels distresses me. From the moment that, you know, you get to check in, I always feel that they're weighing me up and figuring out if I'm the sort of fellow they should allow in. And there's always that dispiriting moment at reception when they tell you that you have to pay an extra 20 quid just to park your car overnight. Yeah. And also that with the Dremel business, we've discussed this before, where they give you an entry card for your room that never works.
Oh, yes. You walk for miles. You eventually get to a room. You stand there for 15 minutes jamming this card into the door. You know that... That again, creeping anxiety that you're going to have to go back to reception
all
and say
the, way back.
The key doesn't work.
And then, you know, that the ordeal the following morning. I mean, I know you had your experience in your boutique place, but I always get quite anxious about this because you wake up the following morning in your hotel room, and you know, you become more aware of a trolley being wheeled along the corridor, and it's the housekeeper. And I always suddenly realise I haven't put the do not disturb sign up. So I don't know if you've ever tried opening the door a crack and trying to squeeze the sign up to the door handle while I'm trying to hide behind the same door.
Well, what,
that's really stressful.
What's the earliest housekeeping have ever crashed in on you? Because
half seven.
Yes, exactly. There's a 7:10 once in a hotel in Manchester. The door flies open as a lady comes in wheeling a trolley. Sat up in bed and said, "What those?" Because you have no sign on the door. I know, it's more or less the middle of the night.
And then, of course, well, just, you know, at that time as well, it is the breakfast procedure. And I was... This is what always happens to me. You know, the bloke or the lady on reception the night before explains where breakfast is served, and I forget instantly. It's like when someone gives you directions in the car. I just blank it. So the next morning, I'm sort of blundering around looking for people who look like they know what they're doing. But the thing I've noticed when you go down to a hotel breakfast room, people always mill around the door and take 10 minutes to decide where they're going to sit. How about this table? No, what about that one in the window? Well, what about that one in the corner? Just sit down. Just sit down. And then the waitress comes over, and it's always a complicated procedure. She comes over and explains that you get your own juice and cornflakes. She'll bring the cooked items, but you have to make your own toast in one of those conveyor belt things. Oh, I don't like them. You know, the bread either comes out just lightly warmed or not toasted, or it's burnt to ashes and the smoke alarms are going off.
That's right, those conveyor belt toasters. You never see those anywhere except in hotels, do you? You don't go around somebody's house and they say, look at my conveyor belt toaster.
Conveyor belt toaster. And no wonder I don't like going out anymore. You know, these things are there just to trip me up. But now, I don't know if you've noticed, Magnus Shaw, but Christmas is approaching with the velocity of an oncoming train.
Yes.
A Polar Express.
Yes.
I've noticed a change this year on our streets, and I wonder if this is echoed in your bleak, soulless Midlands shanty town. I assume you have some shops and roads amongst, you know, your little cabins and little shelters up there.
Very Christmassy here.
Yes. So, sort of in your little lean-tos and shotgun shacks up that you have up there. On Wednesday, I had to queue for about 30 minutes just to get into a car park. And I just think the world has gone mad. We've reached the point where Black Friday and Cyber Monday are linking into the Christmas period, which now actually starts in August and is, you know, it's already at full tilt by the time we reach December. By the end of the decade, life will just be one long holiday where we queue to get onto the M25 to join the queue for shopping mall car parks.
Well, you see, I'm sure every listener is now sensing the distinct whiff of irony coming off your statement there, because you began by being very deprecating about the wonderful county of Derbyshire in which I reside.
Yeah, your little cabins.
Yes.
And
then described all the horrors of the wretched metropolis, you see. So, who's the fool here? So we don't have to queue for half an hour to get into our car parks here in Derbyshire. And yes, it's quite...
You may have a point.
It's quite busy, but it's not like the exodus from Egypt. It's tolerable. Tolerable, and what you're describing is one particular city, which is that what's called Lundy something there in the south of England. Yes.
Well, maybe you've got a point up there, with your cabooses and your bivouacs.
Mind you, I say that I live quite near Meadow Hall, which if you
I've been there.
Yes, I live very close to Meadow Hall.
Oh.
Just over the border in Yorkshire there. And
it's outside Sheffield. I've been there. Oh, my God.
And that on Christmas Eve, is a bit like the Black Hole of Calcutta, it has to be said. It's, seething masses of humanity. But if you will go to Meadow Hall on Christmas Eve, you get what you deserve, really.
One of my biggest woes, Magnus Shaw, is taking stuff back after Christmas. I find that excruciating, though I did notice this year, whilst in Marks and Spencer, they try and dilute that pain. If you buy a Christmas gift in Marks, they give you a sort of special receipt that you give to your giftee, and so that if they don't want your hideous pair of gloves or whatever, they can return the goods seamlessly. It's a special, I just got it, it's a special a gift receipt.
Yes.
And it has a deadline on it of the 20th of January 2015. But, I hate returning anything. I feel so guilty. And I immediately, I don't know if it's just me, but I adopt the body language of a crook, of a criminal. And do you know what? Here's an example. I bought the wrong print ink cartridge for a printer about 3 months ago, and I still haven't returned it because I'm sort of worried about the conversation. You know how I bought this here about yes, and it's the wrong. Why did you buy? I then start feel myself going red, like I'm back in the. In the second form of being quizzed about why I was caught in a classroom at lunch break.
I don't really have a problem taking things back. It's just the only problem I have with it is the time and effort involved in doing it. It's like having to take something to the post office. It just never gets done. It just the object that requires locomoting either back to the shop or to the post office just sits on the kitchen table and glares at you for weeks saying, you know what you're supposed to do with me? That, and it's just such an effort, isn't it? And especially post-Christmas, you go to a store to take something back, you're joining a queue there.
Oh,
and the
God,
person at the front of the queue has lost their receipt and lost the price tag, but is unwilling to accept the fact that they can't bring it back. That's the big problem with it, is just the... Just the energy that it absorbs taking something back to a shop is painful beyond belief.
Another thing not to do at this point of the year is to ever go out, because if you're out when the postman comes and it's a parcel and he pushes one of those cards through the door that says you've got to go to the sorting office, this time of year, because everybody's there getting their Amazon and their eBay stuff that they weren't in for. And the queue at my sorting office, it goes out the door into the car park. And
I caught the postie the other morning. Being deceptive. Because I just happened to be in my hallway and a card plopped through the door and I wandered over, picked it up, and it said, "We called, but you were out." Da, da, da. And so I threw the door open. He'd set off up the street. I said, "Hello. Hello, you got a parcel for me?" And he sheepishly came back and said, "Yes, Mr. Shaw, here you go." And he knew, and I knew, that he hadn't knocked. He hadn't tried to deliver it. He just shoved the card through.
because he couldn't be bothered.
Yes, exactly.
He was under time pressure by his ruthless bosses. Well,
he was
royal.
Yeah, he was shamefaced because I'd got him. I'd got him doing that. So you know, this debate as to whether the posties do that. They would swear blind that they never put the card through until they've absolutely do. I can assure you of that. Yes. So the thing to do is to stand by your front door, staring at the aperture and flap. And concentrating very hard, and you do this all the way through to Boxing Day, and that way they can't deceive you. They can't shove the card through and run away without you collaring hold of them.
It's the only answer.
Yeah, it's the only thing to do. Yes, yeah. Otherwise, you're not going to get that parcel. You're not going to get that package.
Oh, you're not. No, not at all. I've got a question for you, mate.
Oh,
yeah. Sure. Yeah, it's. Why, oh, why, oh, why? That's the question. Because every year, somebody or other sees the apparent prospect of making a few bob mm-hmm. and sets up a winter wonderland in a bleak field somewhere.
Yeah.
And every year it's the same result. Families taking to social media in their thousands, complaining about paying 50 quid a head to wander around some old wooden pallets, discarded tyres, Christmas elves smoking Benson and Hedges, yeah. And a teenage Father Christmas in a garden shed. This year's winner of the ill-advised Wonderland is The Magical Journey, created by television's Lawrence Llewellyn Bowen in your green and pleasant Midlands at the exotic location, a golf club in a place called Sutton Coldfield.
Yeah, nowhere near me, nowhere near where I live.
It doesn't sound terribly.
It's very festive. Nice. Certain Coldfield was very nice. Yeah, yeah.
In retrospect, with the event now having closed permanently, what would be your advice for television's Lawrence Llewellyn Bowen at this difficult time?
People think they can create a pop up theme park for a few dozen grand, don't they? You think about what they're trying to do is to produce something akin to an Alton Towers that can be erected and taken down again, and but will still have the same delights and charm at a fraction of the investment. Really, on paper, it's got disaster written all over it. But I think what is quite nice is we've now, in Britain, in pessimistic, doom-laden Britain, it's now a Christmas tradition to have a failed Winter Wonderland on the news, isn't it? As we kind of look forward to it, just gather all the relatives around a roaring fire and pop ITN on and look at the latest disastrous Winter Wonderland. But people still buy tickets for it. This one was £100 for a family to go and visit this.
Yes,
and it really was, as you describe it. I saw some images of this, and
bleak is the
word. Alarming, wasn't it? It was a very small Christmas tree in the corner of a room with a Santa hat on it. And was that a ride? Did you have to be a certain height to go on that?
Television's Lawrence Llewellyn Bowen's Magical Journey, the magical train ride, I've done some research into this, was 100 yards long.
Yes.
It was a 100-yard pathway. But on its inaugural journey, elves had to push the train along because it crashed in its 100-yard journey. On Facebook, someone called Alex Turner complained...
Alex Turner? Of the Arctic Monkeys?
Alex Turner, could have been. About the rubbish cheap present handed over unwrapped. He talked about workmen sitting around smoking and visiting a succession of empty rooms and no baby reindeer, which sounds a bit like Christmas at my house. But I just got a couple of other quotes. These are all from Facebook. There's a special Facebook page set up. Simone Freeman, she said... The Father Christmas asked my daughter if she wanted the ripped present or the squashed one. This sort of lesson in life.
Excellent.
For her little daughter. Anthony Kingscott on Facebook said, we took the 15-second train journey. The train hit a tractor and then one of the trees on our journey.
Excellent. But perhaps that's the thrill. It's a thrill ride. It's a What inanimate object will you hit on your 100-yard journey through the Winter Wonderland? These things have got disaster written all over them. Surely, for one to be a spectacular as they're making out, enormous amounts of money would have to be spent, and nobody would invest that much. So I can't see how they can ever be successful. And but unless, of course, you get you know, the double irony, and people buy tickets to go along to see how appalling it is. That would be
Here's Ben Harvey on Facebook. What a complete waste of money. You basically walk around a small wood while people dressed as elves try to slow you down to keep the waiting time down for seeing one of the various Father Christmases. But now Magnuschoff says the best comment to last. This is the best comment I found on Facebook. Uh-huh. There is nothing for the kids to do. The elf, who is supposed to be Simon Simon Cowell, is completely pointless. There's an elf dressed up to be Simon Cowell. That's surely worth the admission money alone. But what's that got to do with Christmas? The elf who is supposed to be Simon Cowell is completely pointless.
Yes, well, by definition. No matter how convincing this Simon Cowell elf is, he's pointless by his very existence.
Well, next year, I'm organising the Dackham Christmas Wonderland. I'm moving into this market, and it's £100. And this is what's going to happen. First, you'll enter the hallway of disappointment, and it's going to be my hallway, and it's empty except for a pair of muddy Wellington boots. Yeah. Then the Garden of Broken Dreams. That's going to be a 10-second stroll around by the bins. And finally, Santa's Shed of Misery. And you open the door. I'm in there dressed as Father Christmas, and you have to give me a present before my elves show you to the exit. Bargain, £100.
Will any of them be dressed as leading TV
Simon
personalities?
Cowell, yes. That's right. They'll all be dressed as members of the X Factor jury.
Yeah, yeah, okay. Well, good. I shall be there on comps, of course. I expect to be there on comps, but I will certainly support you in that endeavour, yeah.
No, I'm really disappointed that Lawrence Llewellyn Bowen's Winter Wonderland has shut down, because I was actually going to ask you to... I thought it was nearby, and
not.
I was going to go and ask you to enjoy it for yourself and report
back. Nowhere near. Certain Caulfield's on the outskirts of Birmingham, you fool.
Yes, well, you tell me you're in the Midlands.
Yes, I live in Derbyshire, near the Peak District.
Splitting hairs again. one of the most extraordinary media stories of 2014 has rolled up right here at the end of the year. You've probably noticed that North Korea's very own Santa Claus, Kim Jong-un, is now running Hollywood.
Actually, it just occurs to me that Kim Jong-un resembles nothing less than an elf dressed as Simon Cowell.
Simon Cowell! Maybe it was part of a plot. Not only are they taking over Sony, but they're taking over television Lawrence Llewellyn Bowen's Winter Wonderland.
That's it.
Well, this bizarre story, it started with the leaking of embarrassing emails between Sony, or as they say in America, Sony, executives. And it's reached a new level where the hackers, allegedly initiated by the North Korean dictator, have demanded that Sony withdraw a movie, The Interview, because it depicts the attempted assassination of Kim Jong-un. And here's the thing. Sony have agreed. No release, withdrawn from cinema, no release, no DVD, no video on demand. Have Sony made the right decision?
No, I thought America was the land of the free, that they would stand against oppression and censorship and fight for their rights till their dying breath to do exactly what they want when they want to do it. It's the First Amendment and all that. the first sign of a little hacking, a little controversy, and Sony pulled the plug on their movie. This is the most timid thing I've ever seen in my life. But everybody I have spoken to with any insight into these things is almost 100% convinced that the hack didn't come from North Korea anyway. And is probably some mischief making from possibly not anonymous, but a group such as that, you know, a group of hackers somewhere trying to shake things up a bit.
Are you saying we should be looking in the Ecuadorian embassy for some answers?
Yeah, if you like, yeah. any associated group thereof. And what on earth is Sony so scared of? I've never heard such a fuss in all my life. And surely, if America stands for anything, it is that freedom to say and do whatever you want. And the threat of a hacker you can't even identify, they've pulled a movie, just seems extraordinarily timid and cowardly to me.
I was thinking about this, and I totally understand your point, but I wonder whether the psyche of America, the nation, you know, it's not used to attack at home, which was why 9/11 changed the landscape forever. And I think, you know, over here, particularly in the British Isles, sadly and appallingly, we're quite used to acts of, as they call it, terror. But they really aren't used to that in America. And I wonder if that's got something to do with it, that, you know, we tend to be slightly more resilient in thinking, oh, you know, heard it all before, let's just carry on.
But there's a universal difference between having some files stolen from the back end of your computer system and 9/11, isn't there? There's just parallel at all.
The hackers have threatened a 9/11 style attack if the movie was shown. But as you say, many have expressed concern, apart from yourself. Aaron Sorkin says, quote, the US has succumbed to an unprecedented attack on our most cherished bedrock, the principle of free speech, yes, by a group of North Korean terrorists, which is largely what you know, you were saying. Commentators have estimated that this movie with Seth Rogen and James Franco, it would have made about $100 million at the box office alone, so that's lost. But yes, I mean, have Sony also lost their credibility? President Obama said Wednesday, he said, my recommendation would be that people go to the movies. And I thought, well, that's fine. That's the sort of thing our, you know, Her Majesty the Queen would say here, isn't it? You know, we must carry on, or Mr. Cameron would say. But I thought, well, there's not much chance of President Obama and Michelle rocking up to their local AMC in Washington at the moment. So it's perhaps a bit easier for him to say. Rob Lowe on Twitter said, wow, everyone caved. The hackers won. Yes. An utter and complete victory for them.
Yeah, it is. The only slightly alternative viewpoint is, could this all be built around a PR exercise?
Oh no, that would be disastrous if that was the
case.
Could
it be that there is no hack, there is no withdrawal of the film, it is all part of the film? Now that would be quite intriguing, wouldn't it? But to pull it out of cinemas would seem to be give the lie to that. That would be rather self-defeating. But up to the point they pulled it, I did wonder, hold on, yeah, this is all about, you know, covert operations, and what could be more covert than a hack and the story that the film has been stolen from Sony's systems? And I just thought, if this is publicity in a sort of, you know, the way the Blair Witch movie was promoted, that introduced sort of elements of real life into the marketing gambit, that's quite interesting. But of course, if you're pulling it out of cinemas, it's unlikely to be that. But it just did occur to me.
Let me just pose one last scenario to you on this point. Yeah. Because in some ways, Sony are in a lose-lose situation. I mean, they're being heavily criticised, as we've noted here, for their decision to pull the movie. But if it had gone ahead and the threats had materialised into significant attacks at movie theatres, then the world would have questioned the decision to run the movie with great vigour.
Yes, but I suppose, but Sony could still say, we don't give in to terrorists. The words that we've heard so often from our great leaders is that that we don't acquiesce to the demands of I mean, I don't even know if hackers are terrorists, so that's an interesting point, isn't it? But I suppose they are, in as much as that they were making terrorist-style threats.
But
to roll over so easily, like cheeseburger-eating surrender monkeys, then that gives license to anybody and everybody to say, oh, don't publish that, don't put that on, don't put this on. I remember in this country when there were demands that Jerry Springer, the opera, was taken off, not from the West End, but when it, I think, went into Birmingham, and the theatre acquiesced and said, oh, yeah, okay, we don't want any trouble here, Gov, and didn't go ahead with the production. I hate that. That drives me nuts, because that is inviting a sort of intellectual dictatorship as to what other people can watch and enjoy, and that drives me bananas.
In a more innocent age, and before your Stuart Lee opera, yes. I was invited to the premiere of The Life of Brian, the Monty Python film, and we were told beforehand, you know, come early, and a bit discreet, because there's going to be massive protests outside by, you know, Christian lobby groups and so on and so forth. I'm like, oh my goodness, you know, is it worth going? But we went along, and in the end, it was just one poor Salvation Army bloke outside parading up and down with a little placard, and that was the huge Christian protest.
Even the
against
Sex Pistols
the Love of
got
Brian.
Better than that, didn't they? they got people singing hymns outside their gig. As always with these things, that the outrage at the time sort of fades into farce with the passage of time, doesn't it? So that, that when we reflect on it, we think people were singing hymns against Satan outside a Sex Pistols gig. How quaint! So the outrage is very much trapped in its own contemporary times, isn't it? And on reflection, it never seems that outrageous. But,
no, that's right. I, you know, as we record this, this story is still very much in the air, and I think it's probably still got quite a journey to run. But where we're headed in this increasingly confusing and confused world, I just don't know.
Kim Jong-un has sign-off, has veto on all Hollywood movies, so. Henceforth, then we've certainly taken the wrong turn somewhere.
Yes, that last season of Mad Men now has to be cleared in North Korea before...
Of course, Kim Jong-un is lapping this up, because I'm convinced that the hack didn't come from North Korea, and even if it did, it wasn't at the behest of Kim Jong-un, who probably doesn't really understand the internet in any meaningful way. And but of course, he has he's gained all the kudos. He can thump his tub from here to next year, can't he, about how he defeated the Americans over this outrage. It's a complete victory to the wrong people.
Absolutely it is. It's a few days before Christmas as we record this, and no doubt many people in a few days will be unwrapping iPhones and iPads, perhaps even a MacBook Air from around the Christmas tree, all of course designed by Apple Inc. from their huge headquarters at Cupertino, California. Many of us, including me, have come to consider their iPhone and iPad as an integral part of their day-to-day life. We become used to information, music, words, a phone, all available to us in an instant. However, our iPhones and iPads are manufactured a long way from Cupertino. On BBC One last night, Panorama went undercover to discover what life is like for the workers making the iPhone 6. Was your view of the company changed after watching Apple's broken promises?
No, I've always had quite a dim view of the company. It must have been about 4 years ago when I wrote a piece, not for the Rocking Vicar, for another publication, pointing out that their manufacturing and employment practices in China were far less upstanding and moral than you would expect from a company like Apple. And I've never bought into this notion that Apple is somehow an alternative corporation that does everything right and has some kind of sort of hippie ethic behind it, whereby everything is for the people, done by the people, for the people, and somehow exists to make the world a better place. I've never bought into any of that. That's just pure branding and marketing, and they are just the same as any other large corporation that you care to point a finger at. They're in it for profit, and if cheap labor practices and poor labor practices increase that profit, that's what they'll do. And I've always wondered at the naivety of people who think that Apple is somehow, as I say, an alternative way of running a corporation, no different from the rest.
Richard built an excellent report from him. And it reported on 14 suicides at the Chinese factories. And they got so concerned that they put up suicide nets.
Didn't change the working practices, just put up nets. Well, this was, I think, about 3 or 4 years ago. And that's when I wrote this piece. So I've long been aware of the way Apple operate. I don't think they have any serious commitment to changing those working practices. If they really believed in what they said, they wouldn't manufacture in countries that have poor labor laws. They would bite the bullet and go somewhere more expensive that had proper working practices. So
I would pay, you know, I mean, obviously it's easy for me to say, but I would pay more if it's continued to be in China and Indonesia, where it's the heart of their operations, that people are treated as human beings. And I don't say that glibly. I genuinely would. It troubles me greatly. Undercover reporters at this Pegatron factory, which incidentally was a 28-hour coach journey from the recruitment office to the flipping factory. 80,000 people work, live and sleep there. But I don't know if I scribbled this note down. I thought, am I exaggerating here? But it had the sort of terrifying air of a concentration camp
it. Yes. And any assurances Apple gave, and I thought it was quite alarming that they cancelled the press junkets that this guy had been offered as a chance to spend the day with very senior people at Apple, hearing their side of the story, was promptly cancelled and replaced with a piece of paper, which does not, as Bilson pointed out, speak well of a company that tries to be or purports to be highly visible and transparent in their practices. I think any statements they issue to assure us of how much work they're doing to improve the situation is just lip service, because they could improve it very rapidly, almost overnight, and choose not to, because the margin on an iPhone, as far as I could tell, was knocking on the door of about 80% because of these working practices. What did they say it costs to make an iPhone? $20 or something?
$5, $5 for the people in the Chinese factory.
The margin in there, there's plenty of room for manoeuvre. And they could change suppliers, or they could say to their suppliers, look, there's so much profit in these things that we want you to actually double everybody's wages tomorrow. And they could do that, but they don't. So they don't really care. But the best thing I could say in their defense is that they're perhaps no worse than anybody else. The only trouble with Apple is that they make such great play of being different from everybody else, and they're not.
In order to hold all the little parts of your iPhone or iPad together, they have to use solder, and they use tin
solder,
for the solder. Yeah. So we then went off with Richard Bilton to Indonesia, home of the tin rush, and we saw the extremes that people have to go to mine the tin used as solder in Apple products. And there were this series of pontoons lashed together to create a man-made island, and it looked like something dreamed up by Terry Gilliam in sort of homage to Heath Robinson. But here we see we have the issue again. Demand is outstripping supply, so as ever, people will always move to fill that gap. But do you know what it reminded me of, Magnus Shaw? About a year or 18 months ago, there was a terrible, terrible fire at a clothing factory in Asia. And there were reports then, it may even have been Panorama, and we went to see secret filming of the working practices at this factory. And, you know, everybody, you know, sort of came to the realization. It was, in fact, Primark was one of the outlets.
This was the building collapsed, didn't it?
That's right. And, you know, everybody was thinking, well, you know, how can they make this skirt for £2.50? And we found out how. And this is the point. Does anything ever change? I say no. Everyone will still buy iPhones and look the other way. And it's just as no one who eats chicken wants to think about what happens in an abattoir, and just as anybody wants to buy a cheap skirt doesn't want to think about what happens in a factory in Bangladesh, so people who will be playing Candy Crush Saga on their iPad don't want to think about those poor kids in underwater in Indonesia.
No, I suppose what is particularly stomach-churning is the idea that people are using these Apple products thinking that they're making the opposite statements, that they think that by using these products they're making some kind of positive statements about their place in the world, when of course they're not. It's very difficult, very, very difficult to be a consumer in the developed industrial West and do that ethically, because as you say, you know, how can you make a judgment about the tin solder inside not just your iPhone but the remote control for your TV? It's impossible. It's absolutely impossible. But if you can't do that, then at least you shouldn't have any kind of blinkered notion that you're using a product that's making the world a better place when it's doing the absolute opposite. And these people who flock to Regent Street for the new version of the iPhone and watch those poor saps in chino shorts and blue t-shirts doing those sub top of the pops dance routines as the doors open, then yeah, they are all wrapped up in a bubble of self-deception, and yeah, that's what's quite pathetic about it. Call me a hypocrite, I have an iPhone and I have a MacBook Air, but I'm under no illusions that they represent anything other than pieces of electronics that sit on my desk. They are not totems of my moral integrity, quite the opposite.
Well, Apple say, quote, no other company is doing as much for workers' conditions, end of quote. If you didn't see the program, you'll need to watch it to decide for yourself whether Apple are thrilling futurists or rotten to the core. This was Panorama, Apple's Broken Promises. It's on BBC One on Thursday at 9:00 p.m. It's available on the iPlayer if you wish to see it. The reporter for Panorama was Richard Bilton, and the editor was Kerry Thomas.
Yeah, well worth a look. Great piece of journalism. Well, that's about all we have time for this week, and indeed for this year on the Parish Council. We're off to wrap up Terry's chocolate orange in old wallpaper and call that a present. May I just take this opportunity, of course, to thank you, our favourite listener, for all your support throughout 2014. We genuinely appreciate it and look forward to bringing you more of this good stuff in 2015. So it's a Merry Christmas to the eggnog-bound Terence Dackham.
See you next year.
And to exec producer Ronan Martin and Lisa Cordaro and Juliet Harris and everybody else who's contributed to the Rocking Vicar this year. Genuinely great work from everybody. But most of all, to you, the Rocking Parish. We wouldn't bother doing it if you weren't there, but you are, so we do. Have a peaceful season, everybody. We'll see you in January. That's it for now. Bye-bye.
You have been listening to a Dacca Media production.
Lost the best baby that I ever had. Oh. could skate away on. I wish I had a river so long I would teach my feet to reindeer singing songs of joy and peace. I wish I had a river I could skate.